appreciate everyone being here. Just so people know, House Bill 3237 has a few more amendments, so we're moving that over. And just so people know that they don't, if they were here for 3237, we're not going to have our hearings today on that one. And with that, we have all the stuff for 2600. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2600. And we'll have a short explanation and make sure that we have all the paperwork for that one.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Roden. Members of the committee, House Bill 2600 requires that providers of transient lodging ensure the availability of a lift system to allow persons with disabilities to access the bed, toilet, and shower or bathtub. It applies only to newly constructed facilities of 50 or more rooms or facilities remodeled, renovated, or constructed after the effective date. You have a -4 amendment, which narrows the application of the statute, increases to 175 the number of rooms in a facility for installation of a lift system is required, permits lodging providers to choose the type of lift system to be installed, defines a lift system, limits the liability of owners of lodging place to injury caused by gross negligence or recklessness. We have the fiscal and revenue on the -4. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact with regard to that. And I believe that's it.
Okay. So I would entertain a motion for the -4s.
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendments into House Bill 2600.
Representative Edwards moves the -4 amendments into House Bill 2600. Those amendments were dated May 29th. Is there any discussion? The only discussion I will say is that we continue to look at things to make sure that the wording in this one is precisely correct about the making sure that there's a wide variety of lift systems that are available. So we've talked with the hotel people, and if there's anything that we need to think that needs to be changed, we'll take care of that in the Senate, but we feel pretty comfortable with it, so just want to get that on the record. Any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the -4 amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2600 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves the House Bill 2600 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Elster?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excuse.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye. Motion passes, and Roblin and Clem as carriers, because he brought this bill first, and I would give him a chance on that one. So we'll close our work session on 2600, and I want to thank the people who worked with us to make that happen, so I appreciate that very much. And now we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2853, and I'm going to invite Mr. Yandell up. We have some statements we want to put on the record to make sure we go ahead. Yesterday we had concerns expressed from the National Rifle Association, and apparently we've had a couple conversations between now and then, and I just wanted to get on the record what the understanding is with regard to their neutrality on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, David Yandell, Director of the Law Enforcement Information Division for the Oregon State Police. Mr. Harger and I spoke earlier today regarding his specific concerns. They dealt with Section 12 of the -8 amendments, and specifically his concern that there was a lack of coordination between the various state agencies in adopting administrative rules, which would actually trigger the release of the record information to the FBI. His chief concern was that it was possible that the Psychiatric Security Review Board's role as the relief program for the state of Oregon, should it not be funded, that we might have records actually flowing to PSRB and nobody to actually deal with the requested challenges. So we have agreed to make the changes necessary to make clear that the PSRB must be funded. As you know, we've applied for a grant specifically to take care of that for the next 12-month period beginning October the 1st, but contingent on the funding of the PSRB's program, that would have to occur before the records would actually begin to be forwarded to the FBI.
So without funding to the PSRB, that group of information that would come from their agency that they would be responsible for reviewing would not be transferred without the funding?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That would apply to DHS, to the Judicial Department, the state courts, and to the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
And I'm going to answer your question. Representative Edwards has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Neandell. I thought that there was a legitimate concern raised yesterday, I believe it was by Mr. Sterrett,
yes,
about the process that one would go through should you, I own firearms myself, probably be purchasing a new firearm within the next year, and if I go to a dealer and they do the background check and it comes up as saying that I'm mentally defective, which I'm sure some folks in this building may think anyway, but and in fact that were to be incorrect, just they have the wrong Chris Edwards, what do I do to clear my name in the database?
How do you do?
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, the state of Oregon has an appeals process in place, set out first in statute ORS 181-555, paragraph 3 specifically addresses the department's requirement to have such a process in place. And we have an administrative rule. It's OAR 257-0010-0035, I believe, that specifically sets forth the appeals process for those individuals who have an issue that they wish to appeal in relationship to a firearms check. That's at the state level. The FBI NICS also has a relief program in place so that if, for instance, a state of Oregon resident were to attempt purchase of a firearm outside the state of Oregon, that request went to NICS and there was a question regarding the identity of the individual or the record that was used to make the decision, they set out an appeals process for the individual to follow. I'd be happy to provide you with both of those detailed processes.
So follow up.
Yeah.
So could you clarify, in a typical situation where, let's say there is, a Chris Edwards somewhere in the state of Oregon that is prohibited, let's say they're guilty except by reason of insanity, but the database has it wrong, how long is it going to take me? Is it going to take me 6 months, 9 months to, through an appeal process, to clear my name, or is it going to be a matter of weeks typically? I mean, that's kind
Chair
of...
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, I can't tell you the specific length of time that it would take. I'm certain it wouldn't take 6 months, but I'll confirm that for you as far as what it would require. To give you an idea of the numbers, last year, 2008, we had a total of 163,000 transactions in the state of Oregon, individuals attempting to purchase a firearm. Of that 163,000, 2,100 were denied, and 1,600 of those were challenged, and approximately 95, I believe, were actually overturned. So there's a relatively small number of challenges that are actually overturned. I also understand that in the length of time that we've had our program in place, no one can recall where we've ever had an individual who was prohibited because of a mental health-related consideration challenge that they weren't the person subject to that prohibition.
Okay. Other questions of Mr. Yandell? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 8 amendments dated May 29, 2009 to House Bill 2853.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2853. Discussion.
On the amendments?
Yes, on the amendments. Is there any objection to the amendments being put in? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2853 without the fiscal revenue impact statement being available for review.
Representative Berger moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2853 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review. We did, because of that, it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, because I don't like to refer unless we do that. So, is there an objection to suspending the rules with regard to the fiscal, understanding that we are going to send this to Ways and Means? Seeing no objection, then we so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2853 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2853 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on that portion of the bill. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had some opinions on this bill, which surprised me a little bit. I would really like to thank Mr. Yandell and Mr. O'Leary for all of the work that has gone into addressing the concerns that I have raised about the basic rights of people with disabilities, not to have constitutional rights stripped away from them just on the mere basis of their disability. And to that end, I am satisfied that the Dash 8 amendment does that in a reasonable way. I continue to share some of the concern about how to appeal if you were wrongly included, and whether or not we may be preventing individuals who otherwise would be eligible from purchasing a weapon when they've done nothing wrong. And I think I asked the question yesterday, what if there's another Sarah Gelser? There isn't likely to be one, but there's a whole bunch of Chris Edwards. We had one testify in our other committee who was married to Allie Edwards, spelled the same way. So these things, it was weird. So these things do happen, and for that reason I'm uncomfortable. All that said, I am really appreciative of the efforts that went into trying to get this right. So I'm going to softly support the bill today in committee, but reserve the right to change my vote on the floor pending further investigation of how one might be able to appeal a wrong inclusion in this database. And I'll be following up with others to see how that works and watching closely to see what happens in the Ways and Means process. If there's a way to address that there, that would be most appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate everyone's concern about somebody being wrongfully identified. Under normal circumstances, I think that probably is not going to present anyone a major problem. And we do hear, I think the cases are rare, but they occur frequently enough, especially in domestic violence types of situations where we do have a little bit of forewarning on some of these things. And it would certainly bother me if some person, male or female, because if you've got the right size gun, it really doesn't matter whether it's a male or female you're shooting at, some person were killed or injured that might have been prevented if they would have had the ability to defend themselves, which is, again, I think it doesn't happen with great regularity, but it probably does happen. The thing that I guess I'm getting to, Mr. Chair, my comfort level would be a lot greater if there were some way that we could provide for some expediting of any process where there was some type of a threat, bodily harm threat to an individual, where they felt the need for firearms. Now, I'm not suggesting that that it be someone who's mentally ill, that, you know, just because they're being threatened, that we should, for, you know, ignore that. But I am suggesting there are some probably real cases out there that maybe we should be concerned about. And I'm not exactly sure, Mr. Chair, unlike Representative Gelser, who's been much more active in this particular bill than I have and probably than I should have been. But that does, as we're talking about it, represent a concern for me.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be supporting this bill today. As it first came forward, I was not at all comfortable with it in its original iteration and was opposed to it. A lot of work has been done, and I understand the philosophical opposition to the federal law that this would bring us in compliance with, and I understand that even within the community of firearms enthusiasts and gun owners that there are degrees to which people believe one way or the other. I am a gun owner myself. I'm an avid sportsman. In fact, I will be purchasing another firearm here in the not too distant future, and I will get to see how accurate the database is. It's been 2 years since I purchased my last gun, and I just, you know, when I look at it and I say, okay, what are we trying to do here? Well, we're trying to prevent the criminally insane from being able to purchase a firearm. Folks that are convicted felons, deemed unable to aid or assist in their trial proceedings. I mean, these are folks that I think as a gun owner and a supporter of Second Amendment rights, I am comfortable saying that it's in all of our best interests, including, I would argue, the interest of gun owners collectively, that we make some reasonable judgments like this. The bulk of my considerations has been getting that class, that original class of people, narrowed down to a place at which I am comfortable now, and I thank the state police and the governor's office and other folks that have worked on this for the work that they've done to narrow that. I've also had concerns which have been addressed about if there are inaccuracies in the database and whatnot, that there's a reasonable process for correcting those. And if after passage of this bill the world falls apart and all sorts of people are being unrightly denied their right to purchase a firearm because the database is inaccurate, the appeals process doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera, I will be happy to sponsor legislation this next session, in the coming session, to fix that, deal with that, repeal this, whatever we need to do to make that right. I do think that because of all the work, this is a reasonable piece of legislation.
Representative Gregg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had the same concerns that my fellow representatives have had and expressed on the committee, and I appreciate the effort toward mitigating those differences that have been made by both parties. But I still have the same concerns, and I will be voting no.
Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I will support the bill today. I would like to perhaps work with Mr. Leary and see if we can get an expedited case where there is a threat made that can be substantiated, reasonably substantiated, you know, not to forego or bypass this, but to expedite an investigation as to why the person might have been turned down. You know, we got two Chris Edwards and or two Bob Jensens or whatever it is, and one of them is in the base, and the other one is worried that their wife is after him. That they would be able to, if turned down, try to get some type of an expedited process for that. And I don't know what it is or what it would be, but I would like to see it amended on the Senate side if that is a possibility. But I do this to move the bill
forward. And in here, and in the Ways and Means. You can do it there.
Well, that's a possibility. I don't think it'll come to my committee there,
that's
but
true.
Maybe it should.
There we go. Representative Gregg.
Mr. Chair, just one reminder to the committee that Ways and Means committees are not going to make policy changes on bills. They're going to deal with fiscal only. So we should not move a bill to Ways and Means thinking that they are going to change a policy passed out of this committee.
And the only thing I would say to that one, and I wanted to make a statement too, I think that some of the stuff with the expedited way of treating that can be done by rule, and I would hope that we have that conversation when it is in Ways and Means to make sure that we can expedite. This bill came at a weird time for me in my deliberations. I have a bill that I'm trying to get drafted right now as a priority bill for my district attorney about a young man who ended up killing his stepmom, or the person who was in the home, and was sent to the state hospital for evaluation and is back in the community now because was found to be unable of having made the decision to murder someone. So they're trying to get a civil commitment. Not an easy process. They're going through that. The process that I have is to look at how to expedite that process in those cases where we know this one, and actually a death took place. This person is in the community. He should not be able to buy a gun. I mean, he's the perfect case in my case where there should be, he has been dangerous. Obviously, some person has already died. But there won't be a trial because he's not capable of having made that decision. And so that's, from my perspective, precisely the kind of person that needs to be covered in this bill. I hope we have covered, we've narrowed it down. And I appreciate all the work from Mr. Sterrett and the NRA, the people from disabilities groups, truly making this a better bill, in my opinion. And I don't think we comply entirely with the federal government by the way we've done it, but I think we'll find out as time goes on whether that still works. And I appreciate clearly the work that was done to get it to the point it is now. So with that, is there any other discussion? We'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard?
No.
Representative Gilster?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye.
Motion passes, and it's off to Ways and Means, so we don't need a sponsor. And we're closed the work session on 28:53. 32:37, we've already kind of moved over.
Did you say the date?
No. So now we're going to open. Are we all ready for
the work session?
We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 560. Brief explanation. Just to remind us where we were. We heard this bill yesterday.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 560 permits the dissolution of a county service district if it is no longer necessary for the purpose for which it was formed. Senate Bill 560 adds the current statutory grounds to dissolve a county service district without an election. Currently, ORS 198940 permits the dissolution of county service districts without an election if it is required due to an absence of public need for the district.
Yesterday, and I don't see Representative Edwards, I just talked to him a moment ago about this bill because he did check with his people and they are okay with it now. So we have no amendments. I will take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 560 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 560 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussions? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Nelson? Excuse me, Jensen?
Excuse.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Excused.
Chair Roman?
Aye. Motion passes. I should probably give Edwards, no. Yeah, he is okay with it. And
it's his county.
It is his county. Okay, we'll go with Edwards. And then if he decides, we'll change it to Nolan. Thank you.
Bill and I are curious together.
That's right.
I look forward to that.
We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 284B. I'm not planning on moving this today, but I did know that there were some amendments that were have been introduced, and I thought that they should at least be explained today so people know what they are. And then we can decide if there's anything that needs to be moved or not. But I think we had two amendments come in since the bill was introduced yesterday. So we'll give a short explanation. Do you have both those, or do we want to have individuals explain them?
If you're talking about Representative 18 or...
Yep, that's one of them. And there's also one from the hospital. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 284B increases the statute of ultimate repose for product liability actions, including wrongful death, to 10 years, or the statute of ultimate repose of the state in which the product was manufactured or from which it was imported, whichever is later. Exempts manufactured homes, applies to causes of action arising after the effective date, exempts physicians unless involved in the manufacture or design of the product, exempts product liability damages for actions from halide or mercury-based light bulb from being subject to any statute of repose, applies retroactively to halide or mercury vapor light bulb product liability suits. The B-17 amendment adds hospitals to the declaration in Section 9 that physicians are not manufacturers, distributors, sellers, or lessors of products for the purpose of ORS 30.900 to 30.920. I am not familiar with the content of the Dash 18 amendment. I'll let the sponsoring person speak to that one if they wish. I believe we have copies available.
One was here, yes. Representative Garrard.
I certainly don't have any objections to the 17s. The 18s are my amendments, okay, which are basically the Senate minority report on the bill before it went out of the Senate. To give you the quick Reader's Digest version, it pretty well just keeps the statute on repose at 8 years instead of 10. That's basically what... Thank you.
Sorry.
That basically keeps what Senate Bill 284 wanted to be coming out of the Senate from the Senate's viewpoint. So,
okay.
And we'll offer those at whatever time the chair wishes, and if the chair decides he'd like to... accept them. So,
okay, I appreciate that. Yeah.
Question?
Yes.
But it does include the halide.
It
light.
Does include the halide.
Yes.
Light.
For the
exemption
folks that
for those
were
people.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
We do have both the fizz and the rizz for the 17.
So we don't have any of the paperwork for these new amendments yet. I anticipate to be moving this bill. We will put it on schedule at some point, and at that point we'll talk about the amendments and whether we take them. But I certainly appreciate having them introduced so people can have a chance to look them over before we take action on this bill. I anticipate that to be fairly shortly, since I don't anticipate us being here for a long time. So the hope is that will be happening in a very, very short time. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on... Which one is that? Senate Bill
284B.
Thank you very much. and we'll discuss that as we get closer. So next, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 734. I'll go very slowly so he has a chance to get here. We opened a short hearing yesterday on 734. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 734 because we had one testimony by the phone, and we had Representative Maurer coming forward, and I want to make sure that we had a chance to do that today. I don't anticipate moving this bill today, but I do want to give him a chance to give his, and if there's anybody else that signed up. So we'll hear a short explanation from our administrator, and then if we need to, we can take pause.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 734 requires certain health insurers to cover tobacco use cessation programs. In your previous meeting, you discussed the history and provisions of the measure. Smoking is described as the leading preventable cause of death in the United States. It is said that smokers who quit will live longer and have fewer years living with a disability on average than if they continue to smoke. Smoking cessation treatments are varied and may include medication, education, and counseling. Tobacco use cessation treatments is considered the single most cost-effective preventive health care that a person can obtain. Senate Bill 734 requires health insurers to provide payment coverage or reimbursement of at least $500 for tobacco use cessation programs for aged 15 years or older. Qualifying programs must be recommended by a physician who follows United States Public Health Service guidelines and must include both education and medical treatment components designed for persons who have an addiction to nicotine.
Okay. Is there anybody else on the list over there to speak to this bill?
We have Senator.
Pardon?
Senator Morissette.
Oh, he's not here right now. Okay. Okay. We're going to take a short recess while we wait.
Did we move the dash ones, or did we talk about the dash?
Well, we've got these. Just came as far as we.
So we'll take a short recess. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. I think we're getting it ready. There we go. Now we're back on. And so I appreciate you both being here a little earlier and yesterday. And so today we're just having a public hearing right now on Senate Bill, which one was it? 734. And so we are in that particular place. And I know there were some amendments that were here, some other things, and I wanted to make sure you had the opportunity to be on testimony. So Senator Morissette, if you want to go first.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. This is a bill that passed out of our committee unanimously with the support of Regents. And they not only did not oppose the bill, they support the bill because they do this in other places. And so this is a $500 one-time coverage for individuals 15 and over, and I think that was kind of that arbitrary age was, I think, part of the negotiation with the insurance company. But I think that smoking is a very serious problem, particularly with youth. There are more children now who are starting to smoke because of the renewed advertising by the tobacco industry, in light of the fact that they have had a number of lawsuits showing that they were misleading the public, and in fact that's kind of frustrating because they are still misleading, I think, the public. But you know, a mandate is an interesting thing to analyze, because if in my conversation with some of the insurance industry, who many of whom are very good friends of mine, the question of, you know, the money that you save at the front end compared to what you have to spend later on makes covering some of these programs makes a lot of sense. In fact, one of the statements that I've made a number of times, which tends to upset some of my friends, is that insurance companies do not provide health care. They sometimes stand in the way of providing health care by not covering a particular illness, or by having rates that are so expensive that people can't afford it, or by having pre-existing conditions. And so the insurance companies have an obligation to cover some programs at the front end. So I think this is an excellent bill. It doesn't have any. It doesn't have the opposition of the industry, and it has bipartisan support. So I do urge an aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr.
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3, most of Josephine County. I'm here not necessarily in opposition to the bill, but the other day, as listening to the testimony, there's a couple comments I wanted to make specifically to the testimony. Currently, there was a physician online, and he said, and that's usually one of the questions I ask, is who's not covering the mandate? In this case, he said about a third of the plans aren't covering. He didn't say a third of the lives, but a third of the plans are covering smoking cessation today, because, in fact, most of them do cover it. Most of them recognize the value in it. And so it's not an argument. But whenever we talk about mandates, we have to remember who we're talking about. We're talking about the approximately 1.5 million out of 3.6 million that are going to be, that we target with mandates. And so the large self-insureds aren't included. It is Medicare, Medicaid aren't included in the mandate. Now they cover it. But and so I think you just need to be careful when we talk about mandates that we're actually not talking about Airmen or Oregon, but we're talking about a limited population. The second thing is that when we talk about cost savings in smoking, it's intuitive. You'd say, absolutely, we're going to save money by not having smokers smoke. When, in fact, if you look at a lifetime of smoking, that, in fact, there is reasonable research to suggest that, in fact, it is not saving money. Now, for an example, for a PEB or for a Blue Cross, which covers people in their working lives for the most part, that smoking does cost money. But as they approach, you know, if you look at it, all the costs through a lifetime, it doesn't. In fact, there was I'm just going to cite two studies, one New England Journal of Medicine about healthcare costs. And the conclusion in the report is, if people stopped smoking, there'd be savings in healthcare costs, but only in the short term. Eventually, smoking cessation would lead to increased healthcare costs. The second one is a study out of MIT in a book called The Price of Smoking, which is actually a research study. It says, If we were to base our estimates on smoking costs on data from persons alive in a particular year, the prevalence approach in any year smoking would add to Medicare outlays. But the mortality effects are powerful and more than offset the higher cost to Medicare in any given year attributable to smoking. The implication is anything, Medicare should compensate smokers and tobacco companies, not the reverse, based purely on cash receipts versus expenditures. Of course, the notion of compensating losers is a value judgment. I clearly am not advocating that at all. But the point is, we need to know what we're talking about, and this is really about quality of life, that smoking is a detriment to the quality of a person's life. If we're going to make that argument, let's make that the core argument. I have three amendments that I'm, and the dash threes, we don't even have to talk about. I'm not going to ask that those would be offered up, but I had those printed, and we're not going to go there. The dash ones is, and these two amendments don't delete the smoking mandate. They just add to the bill, so it's not about deleting the smoking mandate. The dash one, what it would do is ask DCBS to adopt rules allowing and encouraging insurers offering health insurance to use financial incentives or penalties to reinforce positive behavior or individual health behaviors and discourage negative individual health behaviors. There is beginning to be a lot of research and application of the use of incentives, of both positive incentives and negative incentives. In fact, currently there are 10 states that have smoking negative or have surcharges on their policies for state employees. Most of those are in the Southeast. And relatively new, but there is reason to believe that this is not a new subject. So I don't know what those incentives are and what they should be, but what I do not want is hurdles for people to deal with this, because I'm a great believer that incentives, such as in this case paying for smoking cessation, should be is clearly a positive incentive. But sometimes you need both sides of it, and you need to determine what's an appropriate incentive. So I seriously would wish you would consider the dash one. The dash two amendment, and clearly this is controversial, but it would require a monthly surcharge of $40 a month for PEB employees, Public Employee Benefits Board, to, if they smoke, to pay this fee or surcharge every month. Now, if they participate in a smoking cessation program, they would not have to pay the $40. And so there is a way out, and it's good for a year, and you do it by attestation. You sign a form that says that you're participating in an approved program, and we won't deduct the $40 a month. I'm looking at some other states. They actually pay people to participate in smoking cessation programs. So it can cut both ways. But this bill, their amendment, was drafted some time ago, and it was based on an amalgamation of South Carolina and Georgia's programs. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Would the question, Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Representative Maurer, you support the bill as is, or you don't? You came to clarify. I was just some testimony.
Am I being lobbied?
No, okay. I mean, you're not a co-sponsor of the bill.
I am not a co-sponsor of the core bill. In fact, I did not support it moving to rules. I wish we would have dealt with it in the original committee, but it's here. And so I'm mandated after session. I'm at the end of my mandate list.
Okay. Follow up.
Yes, follow up.
Okay. Well, as long as we're talking about mandates, and there was some discussion on the floor this morning about mandates, and as long as we're talking about amendments and mandates, perhaps I'd ask the original sponsor of the bill, if we found that list of 60 that mandates that was referred to, would the original sponsor of the bill be favorable of stuffing all those mandates into this bill, Senator Morissette? Perhaps you didn't. You may not know what I'm speaking
about. Yeah, the Dash One amendments. The Department of Business and Consumer Affairs shall adopt rules allowing and encouraging insurers to offer health insurance and to use financial incentives or penalties to reinforce policy. I think this has merit in the sense that it does address the incentive part. I mean, the other... Would this add to the cost of the bill to the insurers?
This is not about the state. This is about encouraging, it would be those insurances that are covered in the state of Oregon, but hopefully others would take the lead, about allowing and encouraging. And so I don't know what the hurdles are to incentive programs. You're not, we're totally off your question, I think.
No, I know. And I was just poking fun at it.
But this is not about cost. I think, you know, when you market a product, people accept it or they don't accept it, it's rejected or accepted, and they would have to decide what would be acceptable to their customers. And in Oregon, I'm not aware of any company, and I could be, I really could be way off base here, but any company that surcharges for smoking, and there are some HIPAA rules, federal laws, that prohibit how you deal with this. In the case of the smoking, the $40 a month for state employees is that you have to have, HIPAA requires you to have a way out. So if you participated in a smoking cessation program, that would be your way out of paying that fee. But you could just say, you know, I'm a smoker, I accept it, here's my $40, and move on.
As a ex officio member of the PEB board, I think it would be interesting to take this proposal, the Dash 2 amendments, not as part of the bill, but to the PEB board. Now, self-insured are not affected by mandates, and that's one of the inequities. You know, we're increasingly mandating to a shrinking pool of insurers, and we're not touching the uninsured. However, you know, the self-insured. However, the PEB board has been, in fact, Representative Kotek just got a $500,000, I believe it was, amount of money from the PEB board to go into the reform program. I mean, the PEB board has been very good about dealing with some issues in terms of equity, and I think that they would be interested in the incentive part. I would like to do that, though, separately from this bill. The Dash Ones, I think, are interested, and I'm intrigued in adding some incentive. Disincentive. I don't want to kill the bill. I don't think this would be a problem in terms of the conference, you know, agreement on this if it came back to the Senate side on this. But I do want to say that I consider Representative Maurer a trusted colleague. We're working together on a number of issues. I'm supportive of his efforts in many areas, and I don't see this as necessarily being detrimental to what I'm trying to do, the Dash Ones I'm talking about.
Representative Garrard.
I'm quickly trying to think of how to phrase the question. And how in the world are you going to police this? What are you going to do to the poor people out there whose only great pleasure in life is smoking a cigarette? And now you're going to take another $40 out of their health insurance. That, to me, is not the right way to have someone want to quit smoking. It's an incentive to continue smoking and not pay your $40 penalty. Your $40 penalty or $50 penalty, I'd like to tell you what to do with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I can appreciate the Smokers Caucus viewpoint on this. I believe that human beings respond to both positive and negative reinforcement, and that sometimes both are helpful. If you quite honestly, I don't know how much a pack of, or a carton of cigarettes costs, but it's substantial.
It's about $60 right now.
Okay. I'm not necessarily going to say it depends on how you would term fairness. But when I'm writing the check as a taxpayer, then that person, in fact, taxpayers as a whole, they have the say. That's why I believe, in fact, that insurance really needs to be a personal responsibility. I'm not suggesting employers stop paying a piece of it, but we need to make those decisions. And so I would I accept that criticism, and it's valid, but I also believe that we, quite frankly, need to attempt, as PEB, from year to year, not to spend as much money on health care, because we have a very rich plan in the state.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
I'm still waiting for an answer to the question that I asked.
You can ask him to repeat the question if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that, because I am very respectful of Representative Girard and his views.
Could you repeat the question so he really knows what it is?
How are you going to police this?
Oh, I apologize.
No,
that
no,
piece of it is through attestation. And attestation means that you sign a form. That's how Georgia does it, the number of the company. I handed out, or at least I think it was handed out, a pack of papers. Oh, thank you. And in there, I didn't know what state it is. Tennessee. That they decided there are ways to do it. You can do it through, you can check for nicotine through urine, swabs in the mouth, and they decided that, in fact, it was not cost-effective to do that. At some point, people, it is...
You're going to have to take it.
Because ultimately, it's not about your $40 in this case. It's about, we want you to quit smoking. And so, is there going to be violations? I suspect so, but there's a lot of things that we have a hard time following. So, there is not a great enforcement mechanism. In fact, originally, there was a penalty in it. It's built into the amendment, and I took that out because I did not think that was the direction I wanted to go.
Mr. Speaker, I just wanted to add something very quickly, and while you're preoccupied, I'll do it without you even knowing I'm doing it. The state of Tennessee, I understand, has another interesting criteria. One of them is if you age, there are three things that insurance companies look at: age, whether or not you're a smoker, and your body mass index. Why don't we include that in this? We could do a dash four amendment to this bill that would require the state to take a look at, or the insurance companies, that body mass index as well. And then you could have a sliding scale. So if you are a smoker, well, age, smoking, body mass index should be the way that insurance rates are adjusted. Is that okay, Senator Girard, or Representative Girard? Is that?
May I respond?
Sure.
Since you can't enforce it, I don't care what you do.
Oh. Well, if we get the insurance companies to, if we mandate that as a criteria for setting rates, that would be, we could enforce that. But we don't want to mess with this bill, though. So.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the dash, it was the dash one amendments that you brought. This, clarify, section three, lines 2-6, the Department of Consumer Business Services shall adopt rules allowing and encouraging insurers offering health insurance to use financial incentives or penalties to reinforce positive individual health behaviors and discourage negative individual health behaviors. So not necessarily just as it relates to smoking. I mean, this is a much broader, just DCBS go write rules about how to incent positive, reinforce positive health behaviors and discourage negative. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it is correct, but it is not directing anybody to do anything. I think we have to be very careful. HIPAA, the federal law, is in dealing with incentives, is relatively clear that you have to have ways for people to be out of it. And there may be other laws that would prevent, other laws that prevent discrimination, because I don't think you want to get into that at all. But I think clearly you have issues, obesity and smoking are the two. There are states that have obesity criteria. One is your BMI, body mass index, of over 35, which is 5% over the obese level that they have a surcharge if you are not participating in a weight reduction program. So there has to be a give and a take. There's not, usually the incentives are coupled with also a positive reinforcement. Some states, New England Journal of Medicine published a study earlier this year that had actually pretty large incentives to stop smoking. If you participated and you were successful, we gave you $400. The study did. And that was through GE, General Electric. And in fact, it did. That high positive reward, in fact, did have a positive outcome. But it's interesting because they also took money away if you didn't. So it works both ways. And clearly, this is not a panacea. This is just one piece of many pieces that we need to at least address in healthcare reform.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, with apologies and respect to good Representative Garrard, I think that we all know that the best way to decrease smoking is to increase the price of cigarettes. That's one of the reasons why I'm very supportive of tobacco taxes, and I appreciate the philosophy behind this, which would also lead to a philosophy of supporting increased tobacco taxes by putting a financial burden on individuals who are choosing to smoke in order to incent their behavior to change. What I like about this is that it is linked to some relief if you are participating in a tobacco cessation program. I wish that it wasn't targeted specifically and only to public employees, but more generally. If we looked at, we had the bill about the motorcycle safety plan on the floor, where if you completed a motorcycle safety plan, your insurance company would give you a reduction. Maybe there's something similar that we could do that would incent insurance companies, whether you're a public employee or a private employee, to charge a surcharge to those who are smoking and waive that surcharge if they're participating in the tobacco cessation program. But generally, anything that makes smoking more expensive seems like a good idea to me. I want to help people quit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, my comment to that is that, in fact, cigarette taxes are regressive, and I think the theory of taxing cigarettes into oblivion probably you get to a point on the curve where it doesn't really help you that much, and that you actually lose people to the black market, which I think is, I don't know where that point is, but I think that is very, it's critical that you do not exceed that point. We know that the feds raised 60 cents the cigarette tax, and that Oregon, as a result of that, is going to lose $20 to $25 million a year in tobacco taxes. And so that's why we need to not tie programs to tobacco taxes, unless it's smoking cessation programs, but not tie them to that. I am hesitant. I think we're really close at that point where you're going to lose people to the black market.
Can I follow up quickly?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm glad that we see that loss in the revenue, and I agree to a certain extent that you've got to be careful how you tie things because of the sustainability issue. But if a cigarette tax is regressive, why wouldn't your -2 amendment be regressive? Wouldn't that hit more powerfully low-income public employees who happen to be smokers? like an in-home care worker that's making minimum wage, as opposed to the director of the Department of Human Services paying that surcharge?
Well, again, the estate, not, I'm not talking OEB, not talking teachers, but under PEB, and you could throw in OEB, I guess, in this, but state employees are fully employed, have one of, although I learned last week that, that TriMet has a substantially richer health plan than we have by a lot. But the point is, we have a very gold-plated plan in the state of Oregon with no deductibles and no co-premium, which to me is an issue in the whole health care, in the whole health care debate. Oregon is going to spend this year, this biennium, over $1.2 billion in health insurance for state employees. You throw in the teachers, and that figure is over $2.5 billion in health insurance premiums. We have a vested interest in reducing those costs, and I look at this as a tool, not the tool, but one of many. Hopefully at least initiates a conversation.
Thank you.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick comments. Number one, I do not advocate for smoking, but I do advocate for smokers. And Representative Gelser is more than correct when she says, if you want to stop people from smoking, keep raising that price. That's what's going to be effective, not this kind of stuff. Okay? And I think both of you know how much I respect both of you and what you're trying to do. But this will not make people stop. Taxes, higher taxes will. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Well, you got a lively discussion going, and I appreciate the willingness of it. And you were saying the Dash 1s don't, they are something that might be appropriate to this bill. You would rather not have the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s, but the Dash 1s?
Dash 1s, I think, are great.
Okay.
And I had a proposal for Dash 4s, but it kind of went over.
Well, so. I want to talk with Ron about that, but I think the Dash 1s are a step in the right direction, and it's not going to impact the bill negatively.
We don't have any of the impact statements on either any of these bills, so we will order the ones up and see what we can do and touch base with people. So I'm going to close the public hearing, and thank you for coming on Senate Bill 734, and we'll hold over the work session on 734 tomorrow. And with that, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 780, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 780 reduces from 6 to 4 the number of legislators appointed to the Asset Forfeiture Advisory Committee. You have a Dash 1 amendment that resolves conflicts with Senate Bill 356, Chapter 78 of the laws 2009. In terms of background, the Asset Forfeiture Advisory Committee reviews forfeitures carried out under ORS 475A, civil forfeitures, and ORS 131.550-600, criminal forfeitures. The committee can also make recommendations to increase the effectiveness, fairness, and efficiency of forfeiture actions. The committee is currently comprised of 12 members, 3 House members appointed by the Speaker, 3 senators appointed by the Senate President, 3 members appointed by the Governor, and 3 members appointed by the Attorney General. Senate Bill 780 reduces the number of House and Senate members appointed to the Asset Forfeiture Committee from 3 of each to 2 of each. The committee itself recommends the reduction in legislative numbers.
So with that, we will invite our one person, Sasha Pollack.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senate President Peter Courtney's office. Senate Bill 780 is a very basic housekeeping bill. The Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee is a subset of the Criminal Justice Commission, on which only one senator and one representative serve. Having 3 members of each body serve on the subgroup seems like a little bit of an overkill. In addition, our office, at the beginning of this session when Senate Bill 780 was introduced, was currently currently had 77 slots for senators that we were assigning. We only have 30 senators. So as you all know, it's quite a bit of time and energy on the parts of elected officials, and we are encouraging this reduction.
Thank you. My question is, currently, if you serve on this board, do you get per diem and mileage every time they meet? Do you know?
Chair Roblin, I believe so, but I can check on that.
So this actually reduces the cost of some government by at least one. I did have one person say, why are we, if the main board only has one member each, why don't we move this down to one member each on this board? Do you have any... Were you involved in the discussions about
that? We would be happy to entertain that thought. There are currently two senators serving on this commission, or on this committee, and we didn't want to have to choose between them. But that's certainly something that we can look at.
Because it's such a popular commission. Or was it that you didn't want to have to choose one to be stuck?
Sorry. I'm sure we'll be there. That's okay.
But the hours, please.
Yes, it is.
I did all my stuff on smoking.
Yeah.
So I'm done.
Chair Roblin, quite frankly, I don't think that if the amendment was suggested to reduce it to one, I don't think our office would have a problem with that. I'll leave it.
And I haven't had a chance to talk with the Speaker's office. We have everything I think we need to move this bill. So it's kind of, I'm feeling like we'll go one at a time, and if we come back and they tell us that we should reduce another one next time, and then the last guy standing says, let's remove one more. We can do that as time goes on. But we'll start out with this one. So, do you have a question? Yes, Representative Edwards.
So, Sasha, it's currently it's three and three, or is it?
Yep.
No, it's four and four.
Three and three.
It's three and three. So what I'm wondering is... So the Senate is already overrepresented in comparison to the House. So is this a power grab by the Senate? Because if you reduce it by two, then
just
proportion
one.
Or by one, so it's down to two and two, then two of 60 versus two of 30 is even a lower percentage of the membership of the House than of... What are you up to? I ask in jest.
Oh, I was thinking you were serious. I thought you had Sasha there for a serious question.
Better off the hook.
But it does mean that the public members and those provided by the governor and others will outweigh the... Because currently the way it's set up, it's 6-6, six representatives and senators, six legislative members, and... Six other members, isn't it?
Chair Roblin, there are six other members. Three are appointed by the governor. Three are appointed by
the
attorney
general.
So, yes.
But they're all executive branch people.
That's true.
Okay.
Let's go for it.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 780, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 780.
What about the Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair?
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 780. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? So moved. Representative Edwards.
In the spirit of maintaining cordial relations with our friends over on the Senate side, I move Senate Bill 780 as amended to the floor with two-pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 780 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Gilster?
Excuse.
Representative Jensen?
Excuse.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes.
270 on the Senate. I would suggest consent calendar.
While Representative Berger's not here, we can get away with it.
Anybody? Consent calendar?
Oh.
Oh, go for it.
Gerard's ready to carry it if we don't, so.
It's up to the chair.
Which would you rather do?
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll have Representative Gerard carry the bill on the floor.
Have you seen our docket?
So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 780. We have about 7 minutes. Actually, I'll look at my calendar. 5 minutes on my watch. What do we have?
4 minutes.
4 minutes on a cell phone. It's the most accurate. So we're going to take a short recess. It allows our caucus member who got riled up on the previous bill to take a short break if he would like. And we will... We had a 24-hour notice requirement for this last bill, so at 4:30 we can hear it.
Remind you, Mr. Chair, two of us are on Ways and Means, which is meeting at 5.
Right, and this we'll try to get over by before 5. Okay. So thank you.
I'm back, and you're taking a recess, Mr. Chair.
Well, everybody else is jealous.
Okay.
I have time for a cigarette.
I can go join
so
the
we're on recess for a few minutes. Thank you. posted this bill for 24-hour notice, and we don't want to do things that we say we aren't going to do around here. So we've given the full day's notice, and with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 796A, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 796A requires death care consultants to be licensed by the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board and requires facilities for final disposition of human remains other than cemeteries and crematoriums to obtain a certificate of authority from the board. It expands the definition of cemetery to include scattering gardens and cenotaphs and imposes requirements relating to burials on private lands. Directs the board to establish rules promoting environmentally sound death care practices and requires funeral service practitioners to dispose of unclaimed remains of indigent deceased persons in an environmentally sound manner. The proposed Dash 4 amendments clarify the definition of cenotaph and other clarifying language to the A engrossed measure. The proposed Dash A5 amendments deletes the term death care consultant and licensing and operating rules relating to that term from the A engrossed bill. The Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board licenses individual death care professionals and the facilities where they work. The mission of the board is to protect public health, safety, and welfare by fairly and efficiently performing its licensing, inspecting, and enforcing duties by promoting professional behavior and standards in all facets of the Oregon death care industry. The board's program affects those who have suffered a loss, those who make final arrangements, and those who provide death care goods and services. It's the board's responsibility to license and regulate the practice of individuals and facilities engaged in the care preparation, processing, transportation, and final disposition of human remains. Senate Bill 796A would require death care consultants to be licensed by the board and require facilities for final disposition to obtain the certificates of authority from the board. Also expands the definition of cemetery to include scattering gardens and cenotaphs, and it further directs the board to establish rules promulgating environmentally sound death care practices, especially the disposal of unclaimed remains of indigent deceased persons.
And thank you. With that, we'll have Senator Walker and Michelle Gaines. You made it. I'm impressed.
I did. My staff sent me a text. I'm in a meeting with a co-chair, so I had to fly out of there. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Thank you for hearing this bill. And I didn't hear Mr. Watson, but you do have a Dash 4 amendment, and I think someone
yes.
else has a Dash
5. Dash 4 and a Dash 5.
Yeah, the Dash 5 I do not own.
I think that's from our representative up here.
Okay, great. Oh, thank you. And I'm trying to find something in my bill file, and oh well, I'll wing it. I have this bill before you because I am concerned about the new technologies in death care. And we call it death care in Oregon because that's what it is. It is the death care industry. And I have to tell you, there are some people who been very upset about that, being lumped in with the mortuary people and the cemetery people and the funeral people. But when you're dealing with dead bodies and you're talking to people about death, it is the death care industry in Oregon. Thank you. That was a calming influence. All right, so I had learned about this new green burial sort of movement during the interim, and I wanted to draft a bill because, for me, some of it sounded a little bit odd and new. And I've always been very involved in the death care industry because I'm a court reporter, 25-year court reporter. I retired at the end of 2008. And I have seen at least two cases in my bankruptcy court involving funeral homes. One was a cemetery and one was a whole group of funeral homes in Southern Oregon. And this is a very upsetting thing for people when these places go in bankruptcy or when there is malfeasance. The big case down in Southern Oregon, the folks stole the pre-need trust funds and used them for trips and artwork and nice homes and all kinds of things, and these are trust funds that people pay in advance so that when they die or their loved one dies, they have all the arrangements made, as you know. So each time we have a problem, we come back and we try to fix it. And so here we are with this bill trying to fix some problems and to anticipate others that may arrive. So in this bill, we have a number of changes that we're making to cemeteries and or to the funeral industry. So let me just start, and I really wish I could find my note that I had, and I was looking at it in my other committee, so I'm feeling a little bit discombobulated. But anyway, mostly what we're doing here that is objected to is classifying and licensing a new group of people called death care consultants. Now, I will tell you, death care consultants is the term we came up with because it is the death care industry, but the folks who this applies to really object to that terminology and that phrasing. We tried very hard to work with them on finding some other identifying phrase, but Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will tell you that they are not in agreement on what they call themselves. They call themselves doulas, midwives. Now, I had a midwife for my birth of my children. Never knew you could have a death midwife, but they do call themselves death midwives or plain midwives or doulas or death doulas. There are a number of different things, funeral assistants, home burial assistants. I mean, it's all over the map. So quite frankly, we needed to come up with a term in the bill that would encompass all of these. That is why the bill does not require you to go by any specific title, but you must be licensed under death care consultant. Otherwise, we'd have a whole range of them in the bill, and it would have to keep changing as the industry continues to change. So that is probably the most contentious piece of the bill that you'll see. We have the Dash 4 amendment to address the change to take out workshops. There was some question about someone was concerned that they couldn't give a workshop on how to make a coffin out of cornstarch. Yes, you can be buried in a cornstarch coffin. It really isn't your father's Oldsmobile funeral anymore. There are a number of reasons people are going to alternative sorts of things. One might be financial, because they perceive that dying in Oregon and going through the regular funeral mortuary sort of thing is very expensive. Though Ms. Gaines, who's the new director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, will provide you with information that shows it is not as expensive as people believe. You know, it was important for us to give people options. There are also people, I guess, of the newer generation, maybe myself or younger, who want environmentally green things, and so they want to be buried in a cornstarch coffin. There are others who want to be buried without being embalmed, which you can if you're not crossing state lines. There are all kinds of reasons why people want to do it differently. You can also be buried in your backyard. And I'm really needing to see that is regulated. So this bill attempts to regulate where you bury your loved one. You can do it on private property in the bill. The bill will allow you to do that as long as you own the property. And you also have permission from written consent from the Planning Commission or the county. We also want you to provide that information to the state so that we know where people are buried. We need to know where the bodies are buried, so to speak. And mostly we need to know that so that if you buy a piece of property and Grandma Myrtle is buried out back, or Aunt Garnett, as in Senator Metzger's case, is buried in the front yard of his grandfather's home, then we need to know that. I think it's really important for people to understand that so that you can make choices about buying the property or not, and also so that we don't unknowingly dig up Grandma in the backyard. So we also are trying to be cognizant of the very different cultures that we have in Oregon. There's a strong Russian community in the Woodburn area. They do like to bury people in their backyards and their fields, and so they've worked pretty closely with Clackamas County to try to develop some guidelines surrounding that. Also, in this bill, we talk about cenotaphs and scattering gardens. A cenotaph, I learned, is a memorial. So It's not unlike the memorial you'll see along the side of the road where someone has died in a car accident, and you'll see a cross. That's really a cenotaph because the body's not there, but it's a memorial in honor of the person. Well, we don't allow that on Oregon highways. And now there are cenotaph and scattering gardens that are being created throughout Oregon. People, I think Ms. Gaines will tell you, some folks from California have inquired about buying property to create these gardens. We want to make sure there's regulation in the bill that you are assured if you buy a memorial or create a scatter garden with ashes from your loved one, that you have the expectation that that will exist in perpetuity and that it isn't just some quick way to make a fast buck for someone buying up a piece of property and then poof, it's gone. Because there's sentimental attachment and respect for people who lose their loved one and want a place for them. Then there are other pieces of the bill that I'm going to let Ms. Gaines do, because I just got a text that I'm being summoned by the co-chairs again. And this really, what I want to convey about this bill more than anything is it's about choice. It's about choice and making sure that we don't take advantage of people who want to make those choices. The worst time in a person's life, I think, is when they've had a loved one die or is soon to die. Those are very emotional times for people. And one of the reasons we have a licensing agency and a licensing board in Oregon is so that someone can go to somebody to complain. Right now, these folks who are practicing in this new field, there is no oversight. Ms. Gaines can't do anything. The Attorney General can't do anything. These people can do whatever it is they do without any oversight or anything. Any place for anyone to go to complain. I think that's an important piece. Now, they'll tell you they're loving people and they care about what they do, and I don't dispute that for a minute, but there are always bad actors in every profession, and we've heard about some of them this session. So really, what we're trying to do is provide some consumer protection and also consumer choice. We want consumer choice, but we also want to make sure that consumers are protected in making those choices. So I think that, did I cover everything? Because I lost track of my floor speech that had some of the more important pieces, but I think Ms. Gaines can get the rest of those, and if I don't go, I'm going to get in really big trouble. So do you have any quick questions?
Any questions for the Senator? Nope, I think you're good. Okay. Off the hook at this moment.
Thank you. When the big chief co-chairs call, you got to run. So I'll do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
You can walk slower, though, on the way back.
That's easy for you to say.
Ms. Gaines.
Chair Roblin, for the record, my name is Michelle Gaines, and I am the executive director for the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I know that there are a lot of people here to testify, so I'll keep my comments fairly short. I am here because the board does support this bill. There are many, many aspects of the bill that the senator covered. We do think that it's a good bill. What I want to do is just focus on a couple of points on the one provision that I think has become somewhat controversial just in the interest of time. And that does have to do with the provision of death care consultants. To clarify, in Oregon, we license individual practitioners. There has been a little bit of confusion intermixing the idea of an individual funeral service practitioner and a funeral establishment or a funeral home. There are many individuals, and as the demographics in Oregon continue to change, who, as the senator says, do not want their parents' funeral. And it is important, we believe, to have choice and access to that choice. There are two existing licenses right now for individual practitioners. And again, just to underscore, it's the person who's being licensed, not the facility. So whether they're practicing in a funeral home or helping with a home funeral, if they are practicing within the scope of the existing licenses, then under existing Oregon law, they would need to have that license. A funeral service practitioner is defined as a person who directly or indirectly for payment supervises the care, handling, transportation of human remains. So if anybody is doing that, irrespective of the location, they would require that license. There is a second individual practitioner license, which is called an embalming license, which actually most people think of the chemical process of embalming, but in Oregon that license covers two things, prevention from decay and the sanitizing or the washing of the remains. If you do that, the hands-on with human remains themselves, either of those two things, then under existing law you require an embalming license. What this bill does is it adds a third individual practitioner license, which is somewhat based on the indirect supervision, but if somebody is engaging their right under Oregon law to act as their own funeral service practitioner for somebody that they have the right to control remains, which is under 432, there are individuals who are moving into the practice of providing professional advisory services, if you will, to help consumers do it themselves. You can do it yourself in Oregon. You do not need to embalm remains, and there are many different options for a funeral service or for disposition of the remains. This bill would also add more options for Oregonians for new types of disposition beyond burial or cremation, and I can speak to any of that if there's time or at a later date for the committee. The one of the advantages that we see on the board is that, as the Senator said, there are many different practitioners, and the scope of practice hasn't solidified. There are folks more in the doula range, if you will, who focus on the individual who is passing. And they work with that individual to work through the grief and work with the family. There are other individuals that want to focus on the environmental or the green portion of it or the disposition itself or doing the home wake or the funeral. All this is saying is that if you are going to charge for your services, then you need to have the appropriate license. A funeral service practitioner and license under that license in Oregon could now, and some do advise on home funerals and do assist consumers in doing that. What we have is a grassroots community that has grown up, and it has become unclear, is this the same thing? They're assisting with funeral services, or is it something that should be unregulated? At the board, we do feel that it should be because only the location has changed, that they, if they're charging for their services and they're providing that funeral assistance and that professional expertise, then the consumer should have recourse to file a complaint and to maintain that scope of practice. I'll leave it there. I apologize for being somewhat discombobulated myself.
Any further questions? Representative?
Thank you for... Let me go back a little bit on your testimony. Are you proposing by this bill to have, you've got practitioners and you've got embalming license. Are you proposing a third category of license or only that certain people go under the practitioner license?
Chair Roblum, Representative Berger, the way the bill is written, it would add a third category. And what it does is it actually has a separate set of requirements. The bill would require an exam. It does allow for administrative rule for the board to set other requirements, but it actually would not, it would provide another window that, in my personal opinion, would actually allow for these practitioners to have a license that would not require the more traditional path of apprenticeship in a funeral home and some of the other requirements that would otherwise be required with the FSP license.
But that would be determined by rule?
Yes, the way the bill is written, it would allow for it says that they have to meet an exam. And what we had talked about on the Senate side is that that would cover Oregon and federal law, communicable diseases, and anything else relevant to the practice through the administrative rulemaking process.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
how much does it cost to maintain a practitioner's license or an embalming license, and how much would you anticipate would be the yearly rate for this other license?
I would anticipate that they would be equivalent, and it's approximately $80 a year equivalent for an individual practitioner.
And how much training does a practitioner have currently, and is there an ongoing licensure requirement?
It's on a two-year renewal process for the license, and the requirements are education and an internship, apprenticeship of a certain number of hours. That's what is required for the funeral service practitioner license. There's an additional requirement, an apprenticeship, if a person would like to get an embalming license. And there
Okay. So what you're envisioning, Mr. Chair, if you have no
please,
for this new set is that you would make the rules, and then who would provide the training?
And I think that's part of, in working with the broader community, the exam would be pretty straightforward.
But the exam would be comparable to what the practitioner's exam is? Is that why you say it's straightforward?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then the ongoing requirements, who would do the, I mean, if they're not going to be under practicum in a facility, then where would they get training for this exam? Through your agency? Would you be offering classes?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, I believe that it was left open so that could be developed through the public process. There are emerging certifications that are offered in other states. I think that those could be viable educational offerings. I think it would be worth exploring in public discussion whether apprenticeship with others who are in that practice would make sense. Those are, I think, some of the things that have been discussed.
One more question, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. One more. Then I'm done.
No problem.
Have you received or lodged, reportable complaints from your agency or to your agency about this potential third category?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, it's difficult because we take complaints against licensees. Since they aren't licensees, there isn't a reportable category. If you look at the practice and if you look at individual practitioners who have in some way harmed a consumer, which ranges anywhere from misquotes on the pricing to not having interacted with the person appropriately, we do receive about 200 complaints on average per year.
And how many are with regard to the category of people that you are proposing to regulate? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I know.
There can't be any.
Right.
Because
so
they're not regulated.
So you're looking for a problem to regulate that you don't have any document that says there's a problem, is the point I'm trying to make.
I understand and I appreciate that perspective. The way the board has looked at it is that when a consumer goes through a loss, and I've been through several personally. As all of us have. And I am not from the funeral industry myself, just as another point of clarification. The position of the board is that individual practitioners, when dealing with folks, when they're dealing with this kind of grief, that folks can be very vulnerable. We're not really able to make informed decisions at that time. And with the increased popularity, the concern is that individuals will move into this and take advantage of individuals. We're in the business of protecting consumers. We license individual practitioners. And so our view is that this is just a natural evolution of where we see the practice headed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really am not trying to beat a dead horse. I do want to understand better, though, this third license. Because I caught that there's a currently, on my notes here, it says there's a funeral service practitioner license and an embalming license. And then the third, I wasn't ever clear other than this new category, but what exactly we're licensing. What is that category? And you made a reference to the location being different. So is it the same as funeral service practitioners if you do any of that stuff only outside of a specific location? I just was fuzzy about that.
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, I apologize in that the individual practitioner licenses are not connected to location at all. So either of the two existing ones, a funeral service practitioner could assist with a home funeral. There are funerals that occur in bowling alleys or in the traditional funeral homes. This third category is very similar to the clause in the existing funeral service practitioner that deals with indirect supervision of the care, preparation, or transportation of remains. What it does is it creates another category for folks who want to assist Oregonians, consumers who want to act as their own funeral service practitioner. So they aren't directly making the arrangements, they aren't directly handling the remains, but they're providing their professional expertise. That could be done with the funeral service practitioner license, or if this provision moves forward, a person could specialize in that and receive this license.
Follow. And so when you say act as their own, you mean not as a, because we license individual practitioners in acting as, we're not talking about licensing consumers, we're talking about licensed people that assist, consult.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, in 432, it does give the right to any individual to act as a funeral service practitioner, in other words, to make the arrangements. The key there is that you have the right to control the disposition and you never receive payment.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have one. As I have now had to take time to figure out what all this is, and that's the fun thing about Rules Committee, we do get a cross-section of stuff. And having talked to some of the people who provide some of the services, as I read it, there's a number of them who probably are breaking the law with regard to the definition of what embalming is. Because embalming is not necessarily putting chemicals into the body.
Correct.
If they move the body and or put makeup on the body or clean the body, they are actually performing a duty that is required to have an embalmer's license. Is that true?
Under the existing, current. Yes, that is correct.
So if they instructed a family member to do all that, no problem. But if they actually did that themselves or performed it in showing someone, they should have had an embalmer's license. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, under current law. That's what I thought as I read it. Representative Berger.
Yeah, but to your point, a family member can do that under current
right.
law.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll ask Patricia Sweeney, Nancy Ward. Oh, wait, Patricia Sweeney, Bruce, is it Pallone? And Candace Chadman. Come on up.
May I'd like to make my position clear on this matter?
Oh.
Thank you.
I hope that's not worth it.
So, Patricia.
Thank you.
Use the microphone. Thank you very much. And do be sure and identify yourself at the beginning, just in case.
Okay.
Because I know that you don't do this on a regular basis.
I don't, and I call you Chair Roblin, is that right?
Yeah, okay. That works perfect.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. My name is Patricia Sweeney. I'm from Portland, Oregon. What I do for money is different than this. I don't make any money. I am in what I'll announce myself to be here today as a death educator on my left hand and a death midwife on my right hand. I make negative $200 per month in that field. I've been engaged in it for 3 months. It has cost me $6,000 and many, many hours, and I make no money doing it, but maybe someday I will. So that's one thing I wanted to get clear, that this is a field that it's really about honing our skills and resources at this moment. You know, I made a website and I've got it out there, but are people calling me? I've had 4 participants in a workshop since 2009. I've made 200 actual income, and I'm very proud of that. But I certainly foresee that it was going to take another 3 years, maybe 4 years, before maybe there's any income in this field. Because even people, I think they're at the stage of saying, wow, that's a really great idea, but actually signing up for that workshop might take a little while for them to accept that idea because it's of the subject of death. What I would like to point out, Michelle, the executive director of the, she pointed out at first, but the main thing is I discovered 3 years ago that it was legal for me to care for my own dead, and I called all the funeral homes, I called all around town, I called everybody I could in Portland to say, okay, I see that that's possible, but how do I do that? And there was no answer from every phone call I made. So I realized, wait a minute, there's this law that I have, but I don't know how to do it. Finally, through Google searching, I found a woman in California who's been doing it for 12 years and spent the money and the resources to go down there several times to study with her as an apprentice. So that's where I began my journey. And then when I got back, I thought, well, somebody, you know, everybody can't afford to go to California to get this information, so I'll put out a website in case somebody else is in my same shoes. They'll find me. I'll show them how you set that up for yourself. So that's really the impetus for me of what I'm doing here. So basically there's a law that says you can act as your own funeral service practitioner. There's a paper that says you have the appointment of the person to make decisions, so you have to sign that, the appointment of the person to make decisions concerning disposition of that person. So that paper signed saying I have the right to this body, so that it's clear that it's this, you know, child and not that one or whoever it is. Then you would walk to the Vital Statistics Department, and the Vital Statistics Department of Oregon has a home funeral packet. So inside of that packet are all the directions that you need, the death certificate, the tag that you would put onto the casket. So it's all set up for a family to do that, the directions on how to fill out the death certificate. One thing that was really fascinating when I studied this is to realize how easy it is to fill out the death certificate. That was a big eye-opener for me. It was a half a page of vital statistics. And that the death certificate is a carbon copy. So one is the transportation, one goes to the vital statistics, one goes with the cemetery, the place of final disposition. So it's not as complicated as it might seem at the beginning, so I really wanted to help the society cut through the fear and the complications. So then after that, I actually had my own problem on my hands, which was in my case of my own death, I wanted to appoint my husband as that person, but he's a quadriplegic. So I was like, well, what's he going to do? How's he going to be in charge of my body but needing a difficulty actually taking care of it? So I had to finish mine. And so in September of 2008, I had to go to the Oregon Cemetery Mortuary Board, and I presented my question. And here it is. Is there any law that prevents my husband, as the person who is acting as the funeral service provider, he has all the legal work done, from hiring someone to help him fulfill his tasks and responsibilities as long as he maintains complete supervision for the assistant to whom he assigns those tasks? And the response I received from the Oregon Cemetery and Mortuary Board was, in response to your question regarding whether your husband can supervise and pay people to assist him when handling your final disposition arrangements, after careful review of the statutes under the direct and primary jurisdiction of the OMCB, there doesn't appear to be any statute prohibiting him from doing so. Neither for that matter, is there a law prohibiting a licensed funeral service practitioner from hiring drivers, persons to dress remains, apply cosmetics, etc. Funeral homes regularly hire unlicensed people to pick up and drive remains, apply cosmetics, and do hairstyling. So the person who has the right to the disposition of the body acting as the funeral service practitioner and a licensed funeral practitioner have the same responsibilities and the same rights. They are both free to hire an unlicensed person to assist them if they remain in the supervisory role. For 80% of the people doing a home funeral, that would be unnecessary because their brothers or their sisters or their community would provide those. You know, the community would make the coffin, the brother or the sister would, you know, help transport it, so that would be irrelevant. That would only be necessary in my situation where my husband would, you know, need somebody to help him, or a situation where a person wanted to do a home funeral but they maybe only had 4 members of their community and they might need a tiny bit of extra help. It also means that it's legal to hire Joe down the street to make your coffin and pay him for that. So the person who is acting as the funeral service provider has a lot of choice and a lot of power if they so choose it. So I wanted to make that clear. The death midwifery services that I offer, I've been assisted with 2 home funerals so far. I received no payment for either one of those. And both of those came when I was working at the Natural Burial Company, which used to be in Portland, Oregon. So by having that location, that made it easier to get people. They were walking into the coffin store, but, you know, it's not, people aren't calling me for this service as of yet. So I wanted to make that clear. Another thing that I wanted to make clear is I see that the media is making some statements that they're lumping the death care consultants in together with people, death care consultants who liquefy, mummify, and freeze-dry the dead, and that they quoted Senator Walker as saying, right now there's companies that dissolve bodies into a soapy liquid as an alternative to cremation, known as resumation, and they freeze-dry corpses and they turn them into fine powder and then dry and put them in a cornstarch or potato coffin. So I think there's a little distortion about what this is. I think my number one concern, and then backyard burials, the concern about backyard burials, I think I'm more concerned environmentally of the fact that anybody who is dies of a contaminated disease, they are involved in the liquids from their body go straight into the sewer system. And there are no complaints yet about death care consultants, and there are no complaints yet on backyard burials, but there are daily practices of involved contaminated bodies, fluids going directly into the sewer system. So I'm a little surprised that the Oregon Cemetery Mortuary Board isn't addressing that as a concern, more, I think, toxic than maybe a backyard burial. Then a few other things, and I'll try to go a little bit faster, but I haven't had a single chance to really get my questions addressed in this entire process. So I would like to talk about the improper process. I am all for licensing, and I would like to make that clear. I think it's fine. What I'm against is improper process. What I'm against is a breakdown of integrity. What I really think needs to be made visible is when I came back from California 3 years ago, I started engaging with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. There's record. I keep records. I've talked to David Coe. I interacted with him. I've gone to several of the meetings. I applied to get on the board through the Executive Appointments Office of the Governors. Several people have. So for 3 years, I have been knocking at the door. I have been engaging with them. They know I'm here, and I'm not hiding from them. I'm engaging. But what I discovered, and I had a hunch, is I called Nancy Goss Durham, who's in charge of the Executive Appointments, and I said, what is happening to our applications? I'm thinking that they're being put into the recycle bin. And she said, you're right, they are being put in the recycle bin. I said, why? She said, because you're not in the statute. You're not 7 members who are industry, and you're also not in the statute for 4 members of the public who are no interest in funerals. So she said it's a problem. She said the Oregon executive director of the Oregon Mortuary Cemetery Board was aware of the problem. So there was a blocking from our even being the ability to have that discussion, and that was not addressed. So that's that. Then there was a private meeting, I know, on May 15th that was about interested parties, and I was not invited to that But I've been going to Oregon Mortuary Cemetery Board meetings. I've been trying to get on the board. I've been engaged. I'm a visible player and was not invited to that.
I am going to tell you to shorten it up, though, because we're going to have to cut everybody else shorter. We're going to have to cut everybody else shorter because we are already 10 minutes over our
I'm going to continue really quickly with lack of integrity. Had a meeting with the executive director of the Oregon Cemetery Mortuary Board. That was a disaster. And it was recognized disaster by the four members there. And she had assured me, okay, we are going to meet. I am going to meet you again because this is, you know, obviously we need to. I have not had a single question answered from her. I set two sets of questions. One was May 11th. I have not had that set of questions answered at all. Today I received my second set of questions at 9 o'clock this morning, answered by Senator Walker and not by Michelle. She had assured me that she would answer my questions, assured me she would meet with me privately, and she did not. So I feel that I've been completely blocked from that process.
We're going to have to go to the next person just because it's not about that. We need to talk about the bill, not about interactions with other people.
Well, for me, that was more about improper process and not. And so the thing is, I am for licensing. I now do have my doubts whether this is the right board to be on. The last thing I have to say is the birth midwives have their own board. The naturopaths have their own board. We're not putting midwifery and naturopathy with the physicians. The organic growers have the Oregon tilth. They're not under the Department of Agriculture. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Candace Chapman. I'm here as a concerned citizen. And I want to just tell you my own experience of my mother's death. My mother was ill and dying at home. My mother had very specific ideas about what she did and did not want. When my mother died, I was with her. And after she died, I washed her hair. I bathed her. I didn't realize that was illegal. It's not for me to do it.
Right.
True. And I dressed her in the clothes we had chosen. I had my mother cremated, and she did go to the funeral home for a brief stop on her way to the crematory, which was her preference. She would have loved to have gone directly to the crematory, and if I could have done that, I would have. But the thing that concerns me is I'm a healthcare professional, so dead bodies don't especially bother me. You know, I see dead bodies frequently in my work. So I'm kind of used to bathing dead bodies. We do it in the hospital all the time. When someone dies, we clean them up before they go to the mortuary. What I now discover is that's probably illegal for us to do because we're being paid as nurses and we're doing mortuary work that maybe we shouldn't be doing. But it's distressing to me that we're going to tell people who want to help people have home funerals, and we already have plenty of rules of this. This is already illegal. And now suddenly the mortuary board wants to get involved when they see a group of people who might be in competition with the local funeral industry. And I do love the way they describe it as the funeral industry, because it truly is an industry. They have a monopoly on the market, and they don't want to lose it. I find that this is insanity to take up the time of the legislature on this issue in this session when we have so many more important issues to discuss, trying to change something that already is working. There have been no complaints against these practitioners. Had I not been able to do it myself, I would have hired help to do it. I think that we're trying to solve a problem that hasn't happened yet. And where we're looking at an industry that's changing rapidly, I mean, we do the green funeral industry, you know, let's not put all those chemicals in the ground. You know, 3 months before my mother died, my husband's father died, and he had a very traditional, full-on everything, a casket made of wood that was a shame to see put into the ground. It was insanity. It was just insanity. And it was $7,000 or $8,000. And, you know, my 87-year-old mother-in-law, you know, was doing this. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. But that's what was expected. And that's what she did. And I think giving consumers a chance to choose a different way. I applaud these people that are doing this. I think it's an option for consumers. Senator Walker is talking about options, but she's wanting to control those options immediately by these changes. Well, we want to give you options. She actually, in one of the meetings, described bodies as yucky. Well, my mother wasn't especially yucky. She was still my mom, and all I did for my mom was exactly what my mom did for me when I was born. She bathed me and she dressed me. And I think that everybody has the right to do that. And if they need help doing it, I think they should be able to have help doing that. So that's what I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and representatives for allowing me to express my opposition to SB 796. I think I made it clear with my handout. Can you hear all right?
Oh, make sure you give your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Bruce Pallone. I'm an artist and a stone carver. I was trained over 35 years ago in the traditional skills of carving monuments, and I've worked in and around this industry since. I'm also a veteran and have recently been involved in assisting veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan plan and design veterans memorials for the men and women who gave their lives in those conflicts. Many of these veterans have voiced concerns and confusion that the bill you're considering may restrict their choices about ways to honor their fallen comrades with the cenotaphs and the scatter gardens. Over time, I have seen attitudes regarding death and dying change in this 35 years that I've been around this industry. For instance, when I started, cremations were a small percentage of the people, and now they are a majority. Recently, I've been watching with great interest as a major new shift occurs. This is reflected in the concepts of green burials and home death practices. In my opinion, SB 796 is rushing to impose restrictions on people's abilities to make informed choices for themselves and family members. To date, there have been no complaints or problems associated with these new activities, and rushing through an ill-considered bill will harm the public rather than help it. Plus, in these hard economic times, it would add a hardship on people to restrict their choices to conventional funeral home services, which cost much more than simple services and arrangements handled at home by family and friends. Therefore, I oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Nope. Thank you all for being here. Nancy Ward, Jeannie Malloy, and Sandy Bishop.
Right.
Yeah,
that's the bad one.
They knew which one to take. It's good.
Sure.
And however you want to proceed.
Okay, I'll kind of frame the issue to start with here. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. We appreciate you taking the time to stay late this evening and listen to this issue. I'm representing three of the newly formed businesses that Senate Bill 796 seeks to put under the regulation of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I'm registered as a lobbyist for Ms. Ward's business, Sacred Endings, and in an attempt to facilitate discussion and come to some agreement on some of the issues raised by the bill, Ms. Ward and I have been meeting regularly with Rosemary Harden from Transformations Home Funerals, and Janie, who's here with us today, of Farewell Assistance Services. We're here today to ask you to please help us to reach a compromise solution to the opposition and all the questions that have been raised by this bill. We respectfully request that the committee accept the Dash 5 amendments. There are a lot of problems that have been brought to light and a lot of unintended consequences of this bill. And the Dash 5 would go a long way to rectifying the situation. Commonly referred to as the death care bill, this bill proposes to make some drastic changes in the laws in Oregon regulating the disposition and handling of human bodies after death. I'd be glad to explain the Dash 5 later if we need it, but the staff has explained it adequately as well as the bill. Under the current, I just want to point to some language in the current statute. Under the current definition, or under the current statute, I should say, on page 2, lines 14 to 20, this is the current language. It makes it clear what a funeral service practitioner does, and it's stated that the funeral practitioner is engaged directly or indirectly in supervising or otherwise controlling transportation, care, preparation, processing, and handling of dead human bodies before the bodies undergo cremation, entombment, or burial, or before the bodies are transported out of state. That seems to be the crux of it all. So
the folks that I'm representing do not at any time take possession of a body. They're working with someone, they're working with the family. They're never doing this kind of hands-on stuff with the body in a home. The body stays in possession of a family or whoever is the legally responsible party for that disposition of that person after they've died. I want to spend just a tiny minute, and I'll try to summarize it as quickly as I can, the legislative history of this bill. It popped up in March. It was passed out of the Senate Health Veterans Affairs Committee with 3 yes votes and 2 no votes. On the Senate floor, it was passed again to the House with 20 yes votes and 7 no votes. The bill was passed out of the Senate Health Committee with the express understanding that it would be fixed in the House. I would say at 5:27 in the evening, a week before a session is going to end, we're not going to fix this bill. This is a flawed piece of legislation that needs a little bit more time. That's why we proposed the Dash 5 amendment. The Dash 5 amendment would amend out all references to death care consultants and let that rest at least until next session. If there's problems with it, it can be brought back. There's been a lot of political manipulation on this as well. My clients have been absolutely shocked. I've been at this for 25 or so years, so it didn't shock me as much. But they were absolutely shocked at some of the strong-arm almost bullying techniques that were used to push this bill through the Senate. So we really hope that you folks will take a common-sense approach to this and look at what's the cost-benefit analysis here? How much good are we doing as opposed to how many harmful unintended consequences? So I want to quickly go through about 5 different points about what's wrong with the bill or some unintended consequences. Number one, the terminology, and Senator Walker freely admits this, the term death care consultant is not a term that's used by anyone. It's not ever been used, and it's not likely to be used in the future. It's too broad. Current law already covers anyone who might be actually acting as an embalmer or actually acting as a funeral service practitioner without a license. And a really important point here, there's no scope of practice for the newly coined death care consultants in the bill. And I think Representative Edwards was, you know, noticing that. Senator Morris, in 2 different hearings in the Senate, said, well, how are you going to describe in the statute what these people do? So my folks are being asked to go into regulation with no scope of practice, no description of what they can do, but by golly, they better be regulated. So that's a real problem area for us. Restriction through regulation is being put into play where there needs to be at least a definition of what it is that they're going to be allowed to do. Third point, there is really no need to address the concern about backyard burials. That's what the news media has picked up on, this backyard burials. This is really about taking back the traditions that some of us grew up with. And, you know, it's been, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years, people have been caring for their dead. And if you have private property that's large enough, and if you can get through the local land use hoops, you can definitely have private burials on private land. There's nothing in this bill that is needed. You've already got 36 counties with county land use. You've got EFU land use provisions for burials on EFU land, and you've got, in some cases, city regulations. So there's just no need to worry about that. So the backyard burial thing's been very flashy, but there's no substance there to it. It's already taken care of. And there's no health or safety issues here. I've been talking to a lot of people, and usually the first question they have is, well, why would we want to put more expense on, you know, a regulatory board and the people to be regulated? Are there any health and safety issues here? There really are none. I have an interesting life, I suppose, but the Lane County Coroner is a close friend of mine, and I've studied the death care practices for many years as part of a Buddhist tradition, and I know what's allowed in Oregon and what's not allowed, and there's nothing in this bill that's doing anything to protect the public. Those protections are already in place. So your family or anyone is not going to do anything with the body after a person dies until after they get the death certificate. That's the point at which a doctor or a coroner is signing off saying, yes, the person has died, now the body can go back to the family or whoever is responsible. So there's just no need to regulate for that. You've heard a lot about the problems with the stakeholders not being adequately included. It is true. One of the handouts that I gave you, I'll go through the list, but one of the handouts is a list of who was at what Senator Walker called a work group meeting. There were, I believe, 8 people from the cemetery and mortuary and funeral industry, and there was essentially one of us. There were 4 of us, but we were from one single interest. No one was there who is producing the green burial caskets. No one was there that's doing any trainings for people to do this. So there were just a lot of interests that were not there. So part of adopting or approving the Dash-5 amendments would allow those parties to come together for real collaboration during the interim. Just a couple more points, Chair. Sorry. I'm going to hit 2 points that I'm not going to elaborate on. But these are the kind of unintended consequences that are cropping up in this bill. There's a lot of confusion over the definition of memorial on Section 1, page 1, on line 16. And that's what Bruce, the stone carver, was alluding to. There's confusion about whether or not that definition would include memorials that are outside of cemetery grounds. Representatives from the Mortuary and Cemetery Board say it would, and the statute apparently reads as if it would only cover it if it's already on land that's predominantly or that's already
Question real quick.
I was behind on my notes. What part of the bill are you talking about right now?
I'm talking about page 1, section 1, lines 16 and 17. It's the definition of memorials. There's a lot of confusion about
that. Okay, thank you.
But to save time, I won't go into that. And then there's also major concern with the bill, and that is the assumption that the state mortuary and cemetery board would be the appropriate entity to set environmental standards. And I think that that's highly unusual. This is in section 7, page 4, line 60, and there's also a referral to environmental standards on page 6, line 13. It makes no sense at all to let an entity that has a financial interest set those kind of standards, and they have no expertise in setting those standards. Those are the kind of standards that would be set by Environmental Quality Department or, you know, Department of Energy. But you're talking about an industry that is one of the most polluting industries in operation in the United States, and you're talking about, you know, all of a sudden, burials are going to be green. Well, I don't know. It's kind of scary. So, in conclusion, to finish up, we believe that it is not proper to have home funeral guides, or whatever we end up being called, regulated by the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Home funeral guides are offering a lower cost alternative to the conventional funeral industry death practices. This makes them directly competitive with the mortuary and cemetery folks. So one of the sheets that you have is off the website and shows the membership of that board. We believe that it makes no sense to put us under the regulation of vested commercial interests in direct competition that are offering more expensive services, and allow that board under rule to basically, with this legislation, nothing's being written into statute. It's all going to be assumed that somehow miraculously things are going to be done at the administrative rule. So we're saying that please, you know, just take a common sense look at this. This is really about a commercial interest and market share. And as far as consumer protection, consumers are going to be limited in their choices. So that's, I think that's been made really clear in former testimony. if regulation is needed, and we're not saying that regulation may not be needed, but if it's needed, we want to be regulated by a state agency, not a board of competitors. So, you know, please, you know, take a common sense approach to this. If at all possible, you know, think about taking it up during the interim rather than rushing something through.
I just want to tell you, so that you know, people are leaving because we're a half hour late to another meeting already. Four of us were anyway. So a couple more are going to leave, and they just realized that they're a half hour late.
I need to identify the handouts that I've given you. I've given you a two-page document that was put on the record by Senator Cruz on the 28th of April in the Senate Health Committee, and this talks about why he was opposed to it. And there's also a transcript of the Senate Committee on the 28th showing that four out of the five senators put on record that there was something wrong with the bill and need to be fixed. And then you've got the Mortuary Board, Membership Roster, Work Group, and you've also got a very fun piece that was a media piece that was in the newspaper of the University of Oregon. So for your enjoyment, this is how Senator Walker dealt with the substance of the issue. So thank you. Sorry to take so long.
That's okay. I'll just get in a little bit of trouble, but it's okay. I'm the other person that's supposed to be at the other meeting.
I better talk really fast before I talk to the empty chair.
Thank you very much for inviting me here to state my opposition to this bill. My name is Nancy Ward, and I am a family funeral assistant. I live in Scappoose, and this is a very personal issue with me. I came to become a home funeral advocate because I went through the death of my parents, and I went through a very intense 2 years. I was very prepared for their death. I prepared myself in order to help them have the best possible death that you can have. So everything went really well up until it came time for someone to come in and take their bodies away. I wasn't prepared for that. And to see my parents put in a body bag and have that body bag zipped up and to have them taken away in front of me was horrifying. So to make a very long story short, I found a different way. I wish I would have found it in time to help me and my parents, but I didn't. But I have found it. I can help other people, but I can't if you won't help me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak. My name is Janie Malloy, and I live in Canby, Oregon. I am the owner of Farewell Assistance, an entrepreneurial business based on consumer advocacy and social justice. When a family is dealing with the loss...
Have it further away.
Okay. Either way is fine.
How's that?
That's okay.
When a family is dealing with the loss of a loved one, I provide consulting, event planning, temporary personal, and administrative assistance. I got the idea of starting my business when a friend's father died in Florida. She spent a year flying back and forth to be with him before and when he died, and then to settle the estate. This was devastating and expensive for that family. In July of 2008, Mark Stan, the executive director of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, came to my home after seeing my fire and warned me that I was getting close to the line of acting as a funeral director, even after I told him I've never handled a dead body. A few weeks later, I was contacted by the compliance manager of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board and asked to come to answer some questions at the September board meeting. I found both experiences to be intimidating. I couldn't start a business if everything I did required licensing, making travel and hotel arrangements, hiring caterers, gathering paperwork, getting the house ready for visitors, meeting an appraiser, feeding pets, getting bids from contractors, referring a client to a therapist, an attorney, or an accountant, or even a funeral home. Yes, I have studied the death care industry in order to fill a business service niche where I can use what I know to help people.
I know that according to the National Funeral Directors Association in 2007, the average funeral costs $7,323, which does not include the fees for disposition of the body. The final expense is closer to $10,000. So after a home and an automobile, a funeral can be the largest single expense for an average American family. I know that 64% of Oregon's population is cremated, and a family can call a crematory directly without paying an additional $1,500 to a funeral director to be the middleman. I know caskets are marked up 300%, and you can order one online without incurring a handling fee. I know that America buries enough embalming fluid to fill 8 Olympic swimming pools, enough metal to build the Golden Gate Bridge, and so much reinforced concrete in burial vaults that we could build a 2-lane highway from New York to Detroit every year. Many families need and want an alternative to the expensive, conventional, toxic funeral. But if those of us who consult, educate, and assist consumers are tested, licensed, regulated, cited, and fined by a board populated by funeral directors, what barriers will they erect to protect their bottom line? They came to my home, they summoned me to their meeting to answer their questions, and then they used my answers against me for drafting this legislation. It's not right or fair for your constituents to ramrod this bill through without the due diligence of process. Where is the consumer protection in a bill that does not give the public an alternative to a $10,000 funeral? Where is the consumer protection in a bill if a family can't hire a consultant independent of the funeral industry to inform them that there are choices that won't put them into debt? Stop the intimidation here, please. Not a single consumer complaint has been made against a family funeral assistant. So why the rush? Please remove the sections that pertain to testing, licensing, or charging fees that would regulate death care consultants by the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't think we have any questions, but we have one more person. And that's Elizabeth Freed. Is that correct?
Thank you, sir. Do you have a moment, or do you want me?
Come on up. I feel very strongly that this process is about hearing from people who want to come and give us their information. So I try, and even if I, you know, we got it set for 4:30, which it would have been nice if we got set earlier, but we didn't do that. So I will give people time. So if you have a few minutes, we'll take a couple more minutes.
Thanks so very much. My name is Elizabeth Reisemick. I live in Yamhill County, and I'm in front of you as a resident of Oregon, as someone who, for their own interest, trained how to take care of one's own at death, and feels I would like also to serve my community with my knowledge in education and, if necessary, with hands-on help. Like you have heard, there can be a situation where someone would like to take care of their own but doesn't have enough family members or friends, and they might need to reach out to someone like me to help them with some tasks. And as a private citizen, you and I, all residents of Oregon, have the right to take care of their own at death, wash the body, dress the body, put the body on dry ice so that it can be laid out in honor for maybe a day, maybe 3 days, depending on need or maybe religious convictions, etc., and then bring the body to a crematory or to the cemetery for cremation or for burial. So as a private citizen, we are allowed to do that. And also, if someone reached out to me because I have learned about what all is involved, like Nancy or others, by their own experience, having taken care of a family member, if someone reached out to me and asked me, oh, can you help me with carrying the body or doing this or doing that, I can do that legally. if I do not charge. The whole issue here actually is payment. As you know, if so, when you read it, it's like for payment. I can do it pro bono, but I cannot do. But the person who I'm helping would the choice taken away to compensate me, and as a private person, if I need at some later time help and want to reach out, I want to have the choice of compensation, you know, so that I can say, that was so nice of you that you helped me in this difficult time. I would like to give you this or that. And two, with this bill, I see a conflict of interest, as you already heard, because this is much more a service. And a lot of people I have talked to in the United States who do that see that very much as a service, as a calling. And to equate us with the industry and to try to put someone who maybe wants to do it as a business or purely as a service under the funeral industry through the mortuary and cemetery board, I see that as a conflict of interest. And so I hope you will uphold the rights of the residents of Oregon and not limit their choices. Thank you so much. Forgot something.
It's okay.
But I'm nervous, so apologies for that.
Not a
My
problem.
First experience.
I do understand that, too.
And, if something else comes up, may I maybe email you?
Absolutely.
Thanks so very much for your consideration.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 796. And we're going to close our rules hearing only 45 minutes late. That's not bad.